He kōna i Purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakarongo mai ki te Aotearoa whenua. Welcome to Country Life, I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. Kia ora.
On today's show, we meet a Tapanui farmer who breeds head-turning cattle.
We go back in time on a visit to an old dairy factory.
Later on in our feature, we head to Northland to meet a woman who wears many, many hats in her rural community.
And, of course, our look at farming conditions around the land. But first we hear from the man with the most important job at the New Zealand Police. Among his many duties, Community Policing Coordinator Senior Sergeant Alasdair McMillan is responsible for coordinating the movements of New Zealand's two police tractors. The tractors are a regular feature at field days right around the country. He says he's looking forward to getting them back on the road after a bit of a hiatus due to COVID-19.
A big plug to CB Nord because they transport these units around the country because we're one on the North Island, one on the South Island. And here a cop from Balclusa will call up and say, look, we've got a couple of field days and we'd like to go around some schools. Can we have the tractor there? I just get a hold of the Norwood. What's the chance of getting this transported from Methven or the Tasman area down to Southland? And they said, yep, give us a couple of days and we'll get it down there.
What is the appeal of the tractors, do you think?
Right, now you've got me on another pet subject. To throw a pun your way, it is a real attractor. People, now I've had the privilege of going to the Central District field days in Manfield on two occasions since I've been here in headquarters in 6 years. And it is unbelievable. People will come past and stop and say, hey, that's nice. What do you chase baddies in it? No. Well, why have you got the tractor? And I said, because of what it's done to you. I mean, what? I said, you've stopped and talked to us to look at the tractor. Or you've looked at the tractor and talked to us. And then we start talking about, well, are you rural? Are you urban? What do you know about crime prevention? Have you looked online? Have you gone there? If you're a rural property owner, have you looked at the interactive security checklist that's obtainable on? And we hand out flyers. One of the most heartening stories I heard was an inspector in Canterbury when it was down at the, what do they call the national show. This young lady stopped, asked the same sort of question. He told her, long story short, she eventually, because of her conversation with that inspector, spoke to the CIB, and her former partner was arrested and jailed for 8 years because she had been a victim. Multiple times, but because of that tractor, she stopped and talked to a cop. She'd never have done that if it hadn't been for that tractor. But people start talking. We give out prevention advice, and kids love it. We take it around schools. Yeah.
So
you've seen it?
Yeah, I have. And so you're looking forward to getting it back out to some events, I imagine.
Absolutely. We thought it might have been a 2-year fad, and then it would drop off. But no.
Senior Sergeant Alasdair McMillan speaking to Maya Burry.
Now to our look at conditions on the whenua. Our contact in Northland says it's unusually dry. Feed is short, usually at the end of winter, but it's come 6 weeks earlier than normal. It's affecting the market for cattle, as farmers are careful about what they're buying. Dairy farmers are at the tail end of calving, while beef farmers are 50 to 60% of the way through. Around Pukekohe, it's been dry and breezy. The wind made it tricky to spread lime and fertiliser and spray crops. Work activity and crop growth could best be described as steady. It's probably been busier in kiwi fruit orchards, with their shelter belts receiving an annual trim.
It cooled down a little bit in Waikato this week, and grass growth rates have tapered off in response. But farmers have either supplements on hand or a bank of feed still to rely on. With calving ending, they're catching up on jobs before the start of mating next month. A fierce wind in Bay of Plenty this week took it out on avocado orchards. The fruit bruises once it hits the ground and is no good for sale. An orchardist says he was lucky escaping with only minor damage, but he says some may have lost up to 5% of the crop. Gold kiwi fruit is in bud and showing promise, and green is not far behind. The ground is warming up nicely.
Mount Taranaki had a fresh topping of snow overnight on Thursday after some pretty strong sou'westers. The province has a good cover of grass and areas are being put away into silage. Calving's just about complete, and there's a general air of hopefulness, according to our on-farm contact, who was heading out to do some maintenance jobs and then off on a South Island holiday. A sniff of dry on the east coast is making some farmers a little tense as they wait for spring to kick in. They're early docking as the region alternates between quick cold westerlies and quick cold southerlies. Lamb survival rates are good though. Further south, the farmer was in the mud, which was delaying land cultivation for maize. He predicts he'll be burning the candle at both ends to get the job done. He's been shocked at the cost for farmers of fencing off farm waterways, $1 million in one case he knows of.
A farmer in Hawke's Bay was heading out docking before the rain moved in when we called. The showers are welcome though, and the prospect of a wetter October and November has perked farmers up. He says most are good for feed, with stock levels well down after the drought. On Thursday, Manawatu was battered with heavy winds, and on Friday it poured down. A farmer says he had to come home in the middle of milking to strap the kids' trampoline down. He says his gauge was overflowing on Friday morning. Wairarapa has had a blustery old week. Lambs can be seen snuggling into their mums for shelter in even the most protected paddocks. A local wine grower says he's more worried about frost, with another expected this weekend. The vines are at the delicate stage, with buds having burst and leaves unfurling.
Across to Te Wai Pounamu, it's been a week of four seasons in one day in the Nelson Motueka region. In orchards, stone fruit trees are past full bloom and apples are heading towards the open and tight cluster stage. Staff are bud thinning and finishing off pruning. An apple grower in Motueka says his main concern is going to be finding staff in October. Spraying programs have been adjusted for the local peony crop as the season's well ahead of last year. Lambing's done and dusted and his lambs are tailed, says a farmer in Marlborough near Blenheim. But on high country properties, lambing's only just starting. Tractors have been out direct drilling paddocks for summer crops. Some vineyards needed frost protection after a couple of chilly mornings in the province.
Down at Franz Josef on the west coast, it's been an horrific week weather-wise. Buckets of rain came down as the heavens opened up. Our contact has 80 cows still to calve out of a herd of 260. She said she was lucky enough to get some fertiliser on last week, as paddocks are very wet. It was a wild week of weather in Canterbury, with fierce nor'west winds throughout the week, which caused some damage and fires, followed by welcome rain and snow on the upper plains at the end of the week. Feed conditions at the moment are good. Farmers are planting out paddocks that were in winter feed. On the whole, farmers are feeling positive about the coming season.
South Otago's been warm and showery. A cocky in Balclutha says it's been the best spring weather he's ever had for lambing. The favourable conditions have balanced things out after a tough start to the year. Crop utilisation's been so good that he's struggling to finish off all the winter crops. Not a bad position to be in. A dairy farmer near Edendale in Southland says calving's all but done. The next big job is mating that begins on October the 20th. He needs to aerate and prepare paddocks for grass, but because it's been wet, he hasn't been able to get the tractor out.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Mark Tiller loves Speckle Park cattle, so he's making a business out of them. The Aniwaniwa Speckle Park stud is based at Mark's property at Pomahaka in West Otago. When Cosmo Kentish Barnes was in the area recently, he met up with Mark and his 12-year-old son Manaya to find out about the eye-catching animal.
Now we're at what we call Conical Hills at Tapanui on the Pomahaka Road, and we've got a 47-hectare block here, which we've recently purchased, and we leased 200 hectares as well to run our beef and sheep and dairy grazing operation on.
And not that long ago you were working on a dairy farm?
Yeah, 1,500 cow dairy farm just up the road.
How long did you do that for?
12 years we were there on that property, and 3 years previous to that down Port McGargle.
And what made you want to have a change of scene?
Time with the kids, grandkids, lifestyle. I'm 47. Some people might say that's a bit young to retire, but we're going to focus on now building up our Speckle Park purebred side of our operation. and we bought some Southdown sheep, so we're going to push the sheep along in the next few years as well.
Mm. Now, I've come here to find out more about your Speckle Park cattle, because they're not that common, are they?
No, there's about 18 or 20 registered breeders, not a lot big numbers. It's certainly new to New Zealand. I could be wrong, but I'm going to say 10 years they've been in New Zealand.
Yeah.
We've been doing it for 7, 8 years. But we only got small numbers. We were obviously busy with the dairy farm, so we just sort of had it on the side. But now we want to really push it along.
What made you want to get into them in the first place?
We got given 20 Speckle Park straws to use on the dairy herd about 9 years ago. And, you know, you get these nice coloured calves come out, and we want to go more into it. So that sort of got us going. And for the dairy industry, the calves, we had a colour mark, which are easy identifiable as a beef calf. Very similar to Hereford that has a white face. A Speckled Park will give you a speckled coloured animal that you can tell the difference between a beef calf and your dairy calf.
And we are standing in front of 20 yearlings?
Yeah, 20 yearling heifers here, yep.
They are mainly black and white.
Yep. And then you'll have a white one with black tips, and then you'll have the solid black, which we have one of them. And so the eye appeal for the speckle definitely catches people. But white is probably a dominant for some of the breeds is dominant. There's getting white heavy, but you can just mix and match and see what colour you want to be.
And they do come in other colours, don't they? The reds and the browns.
Yeah, for stud purposes, the reds and the browns, they're not what we want to see.
You prefer the black and whites?
Yep. So the breeders make up of the Angus, the Shorthorn and the White Park, so that's hence the different colours. So the Shorthorn gives you those speckly colours, but then you'll get the throwback of a red one, which with the pedigree rules, the red ones are not allowed.
And they're quite shaggy, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I blame the Canadians because they come from Canada and obviously it's very cold over there. So I think the hairier genes, which like you've just said, have come through to here, and we notice, especially through the winter, they're a lot hairier than any of the other cattle we have.
It makes them look very cute, though.
You can fluff them up.
Have you been over to Canada to see where they're from?
Yes, we went over there 3 years ago. There you go. We were over there for 3 weeks, and we wanted to look at different lines of cattle because with the Speckle Park, it's a closed herd book, so you can't breed them up. So with New Zealand, with a couple of breeders bringing eggs into New Zealand, it was a narrow pool. So we wanted to go over and have a look at the cattle as a whole. And we wanted to select some different bloodlines that we could bring to New Zealand and then share the genetics here as we get going.
So how many embryos did you get?
We bought in 24 at that time. And then we've since bought a cow over there, which we flush every year. And from that we get about 30 eggs from 3 flushes.
So you own a cow in Canada?
Yeah, 2 cows in Canada, yeah.
Does that system work well?
Yeah, it makes it easy to use the semen over there as long as you buy a good cow. And then obviously with all the protocols you've got to meet and the testing of the animals. And then as far as getting the eggs to New Zealand is concerned, it's relatively easily. And the cost-wise, it works out way cheaper than buying the eggs off somebody else. But somebody has to wear the cost somewhere. So we thought we'll buy a couple of females. They've got good genetics in Canada, which are different to New Zealand, and our cow is different. Let's put some of the different genetics together and bring them here. So we've got a Canadian line, per se, here in New Zealand.
So how did you find a farmer in Canada who was happy to care for your 2 cows?
So the first heifer we bought, we outright own that. So it grazes at a property there. And then we can either pay a flat daily rate for that, but the other heifer we've decided to go and share farm it, so we own half of it each, so he keeps the calf, so there's no money exchange for that one.
Yeah. If you didn't do that, how much would it cost to bring a Speckle Park embryo over here from Canada?
So they vary in prices depending on what you want, but most of the eggs you can get in from Canada landed in New Zealand for about $1,200. Okay. Where we will flush our cow and we work on about $120. $140 landed here in New Zealand. And it's our line that nobody in New Zealand has, so then when you come to selling stuff, it's something different for somebody else. Oh, I haven't got that. Yeah. We could probably buy into that, you know.
How big do these cattle get?
We find our calves vary from sort of 28 kilos to 42 kilos, 44 kilos from out of the cows. And then our yearlings, obviously the yearlings, when we wean them off mum, they're between 260 and 350 kilos, so very similar to a lot of the other breeds. But our mature cow weights, well, our herd, we want our cows between sort of 500 and 650 kilos. We think that's the optimal size for New Zealand for being economic, both eating grass and rearing a good calf. And then our bulls, some of the bulls will get sort of 1,000 to 1,200 kilograms. So they're still reasonable bulls, but you get, you know, you got big Simmentals, big Charolais, big Herefords will be sort of 1,400-1,500 kilos. So they're probably 200 or 300 kilos lighter than those, but the killing size is still about where everybody else is. You know, that 18 to 20 months killing, which is optimal.
Manaya, you've also got an interest in these cattle.
Yeah.
Did you go over to Canada with your dad?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Fun, different and interesting. It's a lot colder, got a lot bigger barns and so they can hold their cattle in when calving. Yeah.
And do you help out on the farm here?
Yeah, when I get back from school normally, sometimes we'll come out here, or on the weekends I'll go out with my dad and work on the other farm.
Yes. Earlier this year, you won the Southern Districts Royal Agricultural Society Champion Herdsperson title.
Yeah.
What did you do to win that?
Went to a bunch of different shows and competed in a handler's event with about 20 to 10 different kids in it. And they would ask us questions about how well you know your animal and how well you'd parade with it and cleaning it, making sure it's healthy.
Does it take a bit of work preparing an animal for a show?
Yeah, you got to clean them at least twice a day before the shows. You've got to make sure that they don't get dirty while they're sitting down in their pens. So you got to always keep the straw moving. And this year, the one that I won with, her name's Power. She's short and speckled and really well-natured.
So we've been showing 4 or 5 years now. We started with 2, and then last year we had a team of 12. So we all get assigned different animals. I have the ones that take a bit of holding, and then we sort of pass them down the line. My wife will have some. Manaya will have 3, and then we have another little boy called Dusty Young. He helps us out. So we just try and partition the animals out according to their behaviour pattern and the person leading it. But so Manaya, yeah, typically he had the Power, who was an in-calf heifer, and then he would have had one or two of these heifer calves as well, yeah, and a bull calf. So we try and spread the animals through the 3 or 4 of us so they get used to the different people.
What's the first show coming up that you're planning to attend?
So I believe Christchurch, we'll be going to Christchurch. It's just going to be a cattle show. As far as I'm aware, there's no people. But if that doesn't go ahead, we always attend our local West Otago show at Tapanui here. Yep. And then because we've got a big team this year, we're going to split it in half and try and attend about 7 or 8 different shows. So we usually go on a Friday, so Manaya always has a long weekend. So we like to try and support Balclutha, Gore, Wyndham. Invercargill is judged on farm now, and we go across to Winton, and then we finish at Wanaka. Oh, and Tyree, sorry. So we try not to go back to back because it gets a bit hard on the cattle. So this year we're splitting the team. We might have 2 teams of 4, 2 teams of 5, so you haven't got them on. And they actually enjoy it. I mean, it sounds a bit silly, but they like getting washed down. You know, you clean their ears and the boys fluff the tails and do everything. So they do like it.
They like being spoiled.
Yep. Some take to it good, and then the ones that don't, we don't show them as often. But like I said, it's advertising, and it's I don't want to be rude to the papers, but I think it's cheaper to go showing than advertising the newspaper.
And you get to talk with people who might be potential customers in the future.
Yep. We have certainly made bull sales that way. And we did take a little bit of semen off some of the bulls earlier for dairy farmers, and that's helped us along as well.
So what are your plans for this stud?
We want to grow up with the kids. We reckon we can get to probably 200 purebred cows, but good cows. Once we really get going, we want to focus on some key traits, which is the vigour they naturally have. When the calf is born, it hits the ground, it's up very quickly, which is keen. They're good growers, and they're good meat yielders. And everybody wants easy doing cattle.
Mark Tiller ending that story from his Aniwanawa Speckle Park stud in West Otago.
Cosmo's taking us a little further north now, about 10 kilometres north of Tapanui. He's with local historian Charlie Davis, who's on a quest to preserve the last building standing in what was once a bustling hub for a West Otago farming community.
Kelso used to be quite a little township. It's both here and across the river. It was all surveyed, etc. But Kelso used to have one hotel. The railways went through here back in 1876, I think it was. This building here was built in 1913. Three people built it, and I don't know how many people it employed. It closed in 1943, I know that. But as I say, three people built it, and two of them put up £1 each more than the other fella. To cover the cost, and it was 621 or 22 pound each. You know, it didn't seem a very high cost for the amount of work that's in it, because it's 8-inch thickness in the wall, all concrete.
Now, it was someone called James Herbert who had the original idea to establish the dairy factory here, wasn't it?
That is correct. Yeah, he was a really go-ahead man. He lived just up the road here a wee bit. Well, we can see his place from here, those gum trees. Sadly, he was killed during the war, First World War.
So he never really saw this factory reach its potential?
I don't know. He wouldn't see it reach its potential, no. But what say we go into the factory and have a bit of a look?
Okay.
And we'll go in the store here. The bloke's shed are going to do the doors and the windows.
There is no glass in the windows, and it's about 20 or 30 metres from the road, and as you've mentioned, the river's literally about 30 metres away.
It's just the other side of the tree.
And on the topic of the river, before we go into the factory, tell me about the devastating flood that happened here in, what was it, 1983?
1982, we had a 100-year flood, and the water was 10 feet deep running down the main street, and that's what closed Kelso down.
So was the whole township relocated?
No, it was just sort of taken away, cleaned up, you know, everything was flooded. This was a street round here, that road there in front of us. The showgrounds used to be round there. This was all township in here.
And now it's all farming land, as far as the eye can see, apart from this one building here, the Kelso Dairy Factory.
Yeah.
What happened to the people who were living here? Where did they go?
Oh, most of them went to Tapanui or Heriot, and then they possibly moved further afield, you know, Gore. And like as a young fella, I used to go to dances and all that in the Kelso Hall, and we had a shop here. Wright Stevenson's were here, and apparently it was the branch with the highest turnover in New Zealand. That's how big it was. There was a lot of stud breeders here with sheep studs. And Kelso, it had a lot of agents. You know, in a little wee town like this, probably a population of about 150, if it was that. Yeah. There used to be a church right up on the corner here.
Gosh, and this building, because it's made of reinforced concrete...
Yes.
...stood its ground.
That's right. That's right.
And the water would have rushed through it.
Oh, yes, the water would be well truly through it. Probably where we're standing here now, be up to our hips, at least. Would have to be. Oh, it'd be more. Because look at that, there was underwater.
Did you come down and have a look?
I did, actually. I was quite surprised how deep the water was. I couldn't believe it, because we hadn't long shifted over to Marina Downs at that time.
Tell me about your background, Charlie.
Well, I was born a farm lad, or my parents had a farm down Delvey, which is down the bottom end of the Blueys, and I had that farm for a wee while, and then I went to Marina Downs and bought a farm over there and stayed there till I retired.
And how old are you now?
I'm a bit over 80.
And you are heavily involved with the Tapu Nui Vintage Machinery Club?
Yes.
And museum?
West Otago Vintage Club.
Is that how you got involved with the...
That's how I got involved
with this building?
Yes. The Historical Society, which were older people than me, they reckoned they were too old to carry on, and they came to the Vintage Club. Would we sort of take them over? And we did. And that's how I got involved, on the historical side of it.
And so was this building here at risk of being demolished?
No, I don't know. But the council made it clear they'd like something done with it.
So to make the building safe and keep the council happy, did you and a group of locals have to come in and just
do some
reinforcing and things?
Yes, yes. And the Lions Club were very lucky. As you can see around the edge of it, it's been all done up. And the Lions Club did that for us. And we were not allowed to put any new iron on the roof, which you could imagine, because it would look too, you know, too patchwork and modern. But apart from that, the building's all complete, the same as it was, except for the glass and the windows. They're gone, and we'll put wooden windows in it.
Well, let's go in and have a look.
Right.
Watch out for the step there.
Yeah.
Oh, it's pretty run down in here, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
There's a couple of old mattresses and a lot of earth on the floor still, which I guess originates from the flood. There's a bit of graffiti on the walls. But apart from that, it's pretty solid, isn't it?
Oh, hang yes. Look at that for a wall. What'll knock that down?
So this would have been very important for local farmers.
Oh, yes. Everybody milked a few cows.
What do you think it would have been processed into?
Well, that'd be butter. Be butter, I would think. Butter and cheese.
Why did the factory close down in 1943?
Well, it was before my time, but I would think the meat and wool would be taking over.
So when it closed down, was it used for something else?
Yes, it was used for a wool bar. Used it, and that's what this landing wall is for.
So that's why in the main area that I'm looking into now has two platforms where the wool would have sat in the fadges.
That's right, waiting to be sold. But that only be in the mid-80s. It would be about the last of it being used.
So after the flood, the building was abandoned and has been like this ever since?
More or less, yeah. Yeah, there was a couple of old headers used in it for storage.
What would you like to see happen to this building? Because, as you mentioned...
Leave it alone. You know, do the doors, but leave the rest of it here. Leave it here. It's history.
Tapu Nui historian Charlie Davis talking to Cosmo at the old Kelso Dairy Factory.
Tēnā rā koutou katoa. Ko whakarongo mai a koutou ki te reo I te rangi o Aotearoa. Country life.
Today in our feature, Carol's taking us half an hour north of Whangarei to meet a rural woman who can't sit still.
Marilyn Horsford has not long finished a night shift at Whangarei Hospital. Her uniform is off and her gumboots on. She's now working, as she often does, helping her daughter Tennille and husband Russell run the farm they are managing for a friend at Tōwai. There are hungry cows to shift onto fresh grass.
Come on, girls. Come on. It's been a very rough season for them. Well, they sort of had the whole drought and not a lot of feed to start with coming into the summer, so it's been bales the whole way, and we're coming to the end of the bales and it's the start of winter. Off you go, come up this way, don't catch it. So this farm's on the market, and then we sort of, the idea would be find a nice farm that somebody would like a retired farmer to look after, and that would be us.
So how many years have you been farming?
Well, we've been married for 36 years this year, and probably the majority of that has been some type of farming on and off. We spent 5 years down in Hamilton with the kids at Church College, and then it just got too much for us, so he had to come home.
You didn't like the city life?
No, he was not a city boy at all. I was nursing, and we had a car valet, car grooming business down there. And I was nursing also at the school, so I had three jobs happening at the same time down there. Plus, I'd had my youngest baby at the same time, so I was full on.
That was your sixth child?
Yes, yeah. So we sort of went down with five, came back with six.
Northland's obviously home?
Yes, yeah. So I'm from just down the road at a place called Whakapara.
And you're in Ngāpuhi?
Ngāpuhi, yep. I'm Ngāti Hau from down here, Ngāti Hau from up there, my tribes, from my Māori tribes. But yes, definitely Ngāpuhi.
Marilyn lives not far from here in the Maromaku Valley. It's fair to say she's not often home.
As my kids keep reminding me, you don't know, Mum, you're not here. I'm like, I'm around, I'm just not always in the building.
Keep going. When Marilyn's not at work or helping out on the farm or pitching in elsewhere in the community, if time allows, she'll be teaching music.
Yeah, cool, get your words right.
Or accompanying children and teenagers for their performances.
Too much to bear, bless me. So whatever he commands, I will.
So this is our fire station, Tawai Fire Station. We're under reconstruction. Yep.
Oh wow, it's brand new. It's not even finished.
No. Oh well, this is new. So we're going to have running water and toilets and a kitchen. Before we had an engine and a shed and our gear. That was it. And a water pump that pumped out to the tank outside that we could fill the truck with, or else we pumped out of the creek next door here. That was it. So I was like, oh my goodness.
You're a volunteer firefighter.
Yep. Yeah, that happened when we first moved back from Hamilton. I came across an accident down the road, and it was quite a severe one. There was a fatality in it, and I thought to myself, yeah, I wanted to get back into doing something for the community. I guess it's firefighting. So when the guys arrived, I knew them from living here before. I says, when's practice? When's training night? So that's been us. And from that, of my six kids, five of them have joined.
Wow.
over the years.
How does it work? You're rostered on X days, number of days a week?
Or no, we're just on call.
You're all the time?
Yep, so the siren goes up.
And can you hear it from here?
Yep, you can hear it from here. You can hear it from quite a few places. But, the call goes up and whoever can make it shows up and get on our gear and do it.
Do you enjoy it?
Love it.
What is it about it that you like?
I don't know. I think it's the unknown, because you never know what you're going to get. So an MVA, is that one? Is that two? Is that a big one? Is it just a car in the drain? You know, what are we going to do? Is it caught the scrub on fire or what?
Have there been memorable call-outs for you?
Yeah, it is the grisly ones that you do tend to remember. I think all of my kids, they've all had fatalities in their accidents and things. So it's not nice, but it hardens you for life. You know, it's... You just sort of do what has to be done and support who has to be supported and do your best, really.
You haven't been able to twist your husband's arm to...
Well, someone's got to stay home and do the work. That's the bottom line. If that siren goes off and we're gone, he's got to milk those cows. He's got to shift those cows. He's got to do what else has to be done when we're not there. Yeah, he's the stalwart of the family. It's not me.
we're coming down the road and I was thinking, I wonder where the closest LDS church is. And then here it is in the middle of a paddock.
Absolutely. And it amazes many people when they're driving through and it's sort of like, drive, drive, green grass, big white brick building. What is this place? This is the Church of Jesus, the Maramaku Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
What's your role here?
Because
I'm sure you have one.
I do. I play the music. There's another lady that plays as well. I am in the ladies group, which they call the Relief Society. So we help the community. We do cooking. We do helping. We do looking after. We do teaching. Like we had an activity last week, which was a post-COVID activity of how did you cope? What did you do? What would you do differently? Just time for women to get together and to express their thoughts, their feelings. We try and do that once a month.
So what do you do in your spare time?
If I am at home, I like to be out in the garden or outside.
So you don't just sit and put your feet up?
No, I don't.
What made you like that? Were your parents like that?
I was actually brought up by my grandparents. My grandmother was, she was 67 when she got me, so when I was a baby. The thing is, the community where I lived, everybody lived with their grandparents. There was one cousin that lived there and he lived with his grandparents, and then on the corner there were two cousins that lived with their grandmother. Next house up was one that lived with that one. Next one up there was like, I don't know, maybe five or six that lived with their grandparents and parents on and off.
So that was normal for you?
It was. I didn't realise that. It wasn't until I went nursing and the nursing tutor said to me, said in class, so what is a dysfunctional family? And I was thinking, well, that's, you know, people that fight and, you know, do bad things. And the definition was a family that isn't a mother and a father and children. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm 17, I'm from a dysfunctional family. It wasn't dysfunctional. I mean, I was loved, I was cared for, I was brought up well, I had piano lessons. I never missed out on anything, I didn't think. My family came to visit me, my mum and stepfather and siblings. And remembering, I've been a nurse for nearly 40 years, so hopefully things have changed a little. With my piano playing, with my music, I may be Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints by birth, but during the week, I am Anglican, Catholic, Ecumenical, Pentecostal, whatever they need for a pianist or an organist, that's me. Like I got a phone call this week to see if I would play in Kawakawa tomorrow for a minister who was short on an organist for a memorial service for someone that died during COVID. So, and then down at Whakapara, they've got a pedal organ in there, and not many people can play pedal organs.
Okay, so follow you down the road.
Yeah, so we're going to their house just over there.
Okay, and
just pull in behind me. It's Auntie Aura. So she's rang me this morning, and she's got a family history problem that I just need to go and sort out on her computer. No. This is my friend Carol.
Hello.
Hello,
nice to meet you.
Hello.
Hello.
That's
the Kumara
home.
Oh, thank you.
So, and did you...
Amazing. She keeps us alive, this girl.
What's this here?
Kimraho. It's a rongoi, a Māori medicine. It's plants, you know, a shrub that we pick out in the bush or on the side of the road. Yeah, and she makes it up for us. Clever, eh? What this lady can't do, honestly. This is my office, this end of the house.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Where I do my genealogy, whakapapa. And this lady, when I'm stuck, just ring up to her and she's here like a light. This is too much for my brain. I'm trying to learn how to copy, paste, let alone split, whatever they call it,
screens.
Split the screen. Just like that, see?
So, you won't even
Thank
need
you.
To call me now.
Awesome. Yes, yeah, she's a wonder woman.
Enjoy, enjoy, Auntie.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. See ya.
I've tried and tried to find some kids to sing for you, but it's the school holidays. They've all gone on holiday and there's none around. I thought I'd try and get some of the cousins to come from up the hill, but they've gone to the movies and my grandkids are unavailable. They've gone away. And so there's just me and my ukulele.
I'm not very good. I mean, I'm okay, but I'm not fluent. So at high school, I was in the time of the resurgence of Te Reo Māori when it first came back into being in schools after all those years of people being given the cane and the strap and all those sort of things. And so my grandfather sent me to Bay of Islands College to learn Te Reo. And I had a Scottish English Māori teacher, and his name was Mr. McCormick, and love him dearly. He was just so awesome. He was this little fair man with this little blonde goatee, and yeah, but he could speak it.
Did your grandparents have Te Reo?
My grandfather did. Probably they both did, but they never ever spoke it. I never ever heard them. That it had been beaten out of them so much, I imagine, that they never ever spoke about it. But my grandfather said that I needed to go back and learn who I was, that I wasn't an Indian, because at school I had long brown braids, and so they'd think I was an Indian, American Indian, or else they'd put a dot in the middle of my head to be a, you know, an Indian from India. And so he's like, you need to go and learn what you are.
So when you do teach Te Reo, where do you do that?
Hokorinui School, just down the road here. We have lots of fun. It's awesome. I love it. Because it's not just reading and writing. It's like I teach everything through music. So we sing, we learn the alphabet through music, we learn words through music, we learn greetings through music. We just do waiata, 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 and we do actions, and we have lots of fun. At the end of a day, I'm shattered because I've taught 165 kids on an average, and I've jumped around, and we've played games, and we've done quizzes. To me, if it's fun, then people want to learn, and if it's boring, well, why would they?
Your own children, do they speak Te Reo?
No, they don't. And they're like, oh, Mum. I'm like, you know, this is really a bad look. I'm trying to teach other people's kids and you don't want to learn. Tēnā koe, hello to one. Tēnā kōrua, hello to two. Tēnā koutou, hello to all. What we're going to do now is we're heading back to Whangarei, and we're just going to pop up to where I was brought up, Whakapara, and have a quick squizzy at our family urupā and across to the marae at Whakapara there. So this is where I was brought up. This is Whakapara, about half a kilometre off State Highway 1. This is St Isaac's Church, which my great-great-grandparents established when their first son, one of their sons, died when he was 15.
So 1898?
Back in 1898 was when their son Isaac died, Ihaka. That was the first body that went in here, and there's, as you see, there's lots and lots of others now.
So this is an Anglican church?
This is an Anglican church, but in saying that, if I wanted to have a Mormon service in here, I probably could. You know, as long as someone uses a church, that's the main thing. As you see, the grounds are in pretty good condition of the original family that established here. There are 9 children that had children, and so every 9 months it's our family's turn to do the lawns and the weed eating and the weeding and the water blasting and stuff like that.
So you're called into action at the Anglican church as well as your chapel down the road.
Yes. Yeah, I jack of all trades. If anyone asks me to do something, I will give my best shot. I love to help the living, but I love to help the dead as well.
When you say you like to help the dead, what do you do?
I come and mow the lawns, and I bury them, help to bury them. I play the music for them. I've been known to help to do a service every now and then.
Is this church affiliated with the local marae?
Yes, the marae is just there. And so, yes, they run hand in hand. So, yeah, so this is the Whakapara Urupā.
Ah, this is a modern marae.
Yeah, I thought I'd bring you here to have a bit of a squiz. It is a beautiful marae, really, really nice. And one of our cousins was actually the architect for it, so that makes it even more special.
What was standing here when you were a kid?
Nothing. This was gorse. This was all gorse. Back in the early 60s, there used to be a marae, I'm told, a whare over there in that area there. But it was taken down because people weren't using marae back in those days. And so there was many, 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 many meetings on what are we going to do, how are we going to do it, and it's taken a long time to get it this far. A lot of fundraising, and they finally did it. A lot of hard work. And then once you get the marae, it's the upkeep of it. But people are so proud to bring people back here because it is a beautiful place. And, you know, our urupa is just across the road.
It's stunning. You can just stand here.
Mm-hmm. It's an awesome photo.
Yeah, when you're at the urupa, you can't really see the marae. No. But from this vantage point, it's just beautiful. Mm. Yeah.
So when we have tangi and things like that, you can imagine the kaikaranga standing there calling and the people going through the tomokanga and taking their whānau in and then coming back out and then walking the little way across the road through the little gate. It's just really amazing. It's really, really lovely.
Such a quaint, old-fashioned wee church.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. How many does that church seat?
Not a lot. I don't know, maybe you'd be close to 60, perhaps, if you're lucky. That would be at a squish. But you can feel the love. I can remember when my grandmother died, there was no power there then, and they had her body lying in state there, and I was 15, and we slept there the night, and I was just like... And then my auntie said to me, I don't know why you're worried, these people are all family. I'm like, oh, true. And that was it.
And what's your involvement with the marae?
Whatever they want. Sometimes it could go a month and I haven't been back, but come along and help with, you know, join in with the kuia kaumātua. I just brought somebody through here this week that had never been back to see their marae before. So I sort of took them through the urupa and gave them their history and then brought them over here to show them their wharenui and their wharekai, tell them the stories that I know about the area. So that was a good 2 hours trip. Then, like I say, when there's a tangi on, the phone goes, cuz, can you come down? Okay, what am I doing? Like, am I in the kitchen? Am I kaikaranga? Am I, you know, what do you want? Or, you know, can you help with the music? Can you do whatever? In the past, we had three of our family members die fairly close to each other in succession, and so I was working. I was in the wharekai and was setting up the kitchen and stuff. And my boys had to come and take over from me so I could go to work. And then during the night, one of my boys rocked up with some dinner for me at like 1 o'clock in the morning after he'd finished doing the dishes and stuff out here. He called in to Whangarei, which is 35 minutes away, to bring me some kai. So, yeah, that's just how it works. You know, my kids, they support the marae, they support their whānau, they support their mother and their father. So, yeah, we're pretty lucky.
Nurse, farmer, volunteer firefighter, music and te reo teacher, mum, grandmother, church volunteer, producer of Māori medicine and marae go-to person, Marilyn Horsford. Phew!
Well, that's it for this week. Don't forget there are photos on our website. Do go on and have a look if you can. We'd love your feedback too. Email us on country@rnz.co.nz. Hei tērā wiki, hei kōnā rā.
Mā te wā.